Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, we're a few weeks into our life here at the Sandy Springs Innovation Center. Things are going well.
The only thing I really don't like about the new location is it rains every day.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening
I don't
there,
know what that's about. But other than that, I love having the people will walk in and they'll look in. It's like, what is that, CBS Morning or Good Morning America? So I like having the glass out there. And it's such a collaborative, high-energy environment. I love these digs. We're a little slight on signage, but we're getting there. But most importantly, man, we got the best guest.
That hasn't changed.
That's right. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast CEO and co-founder with Kahua, Mr. Scott Unger. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Stone. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get too far into things, tell us about Kahua. How are you serving folks?
Kahua is a project management solution for the real estate design and construction marketplace. And so when you're building a building, very often you'll bring 100 different parties together that have to collaborate and share information and data throughout the life of that project. And that's what Kahua allows them to do, is a more efficient way of exchanging information, collecting information, and disseminating information to all the parties throughout the life of a design and construction project. It's not unusual to have, and on some larger projects, hundreds of thousands of documents that are dealt with over the life cycle of the project. And that's very important that all parties have access to that information when they need it.
So now, if they're not using Kahua, how are they dealing with it now?
They may be using legacy technology. The project management software has been around for quite some time. This is my second rodeo in the project management space. My first company was Constructware that we started in 1994 and ultimately sold to Autodesk in 2006. And we saw another opportunity with Kahua in the same space, targeting the same customer.
And then does this transfer, because I would imagine in healthcare they have similar problems, is this the type of solution that can kind of work in other industries as well?
It can certainly work in other industries. As a matter of fact, our first company, Constructware, we did essentially take a copy of that, spun off another company called Compliance 360 that was focused specifically on healthcare and governance, risk, and compliance. And that company was sold and exited in 2012 to SAI Global.
So now, when you have this new technology and you already have a reputation in the industry, is it easier to kind of launch this and get this going, or do you have the same kind of risk-averse kind of groups of people that aren't willing to take the plunge?
I suppose it makes some components a little bit easier in starting the business. In terms of acquiring customers, it's probably the same challenges we would have had, whether it was the first company or the second go-around here.
Now, give me the pitch. Like when you're talking to these people, you have relationships with them, I would imagine, so you don't have to kind of prove that you know stuff. But how are you going about kind of getting them on board?
The pitch now is different than it was historically, and that relates to the technology that we have. With Kahua, Kahua is a platform as a service business model. And having been through this once with our former company, Constructware, we recognized some of the challenges that still needed to be solved in the industry. And specifically, that was, how do we really allow our customer to have what they want? Let's allow the technology to conform to the customer's business versus making the customer conform to the technology. And that's the real difference. And with the platform as a service business model, we can allow customers or third parties or Kahua itself to create applications that meet specific needs of that given customer. Each customer can be very different from one another. They need very specific business processes to run their business. And so with Kahua, we can model the software and the application to work exactly the way the customer wants to work. And in our first company, Constructware, we did everything. We wrote this software. We developed the software. We did the consulting. We did the sales. And I think what we did then is we proved the fact that one customer cannot solve all the industry's problems. And so with Kahua, the model is, let's not try to be that one company that solves the industry's problems. Let's develop a technology that allows the industry to solve its own problems. And with the platform as a service business model, we open it up for all different parties, including customers, to help solve their own problems.
So now who is the, in order to use Kahua, say I'm a small, you know, cog in the machine, do I have to kind of invest in Kahua, or can I come along for the ride just being this small vendor as part of the project?
Either way, it would be a fairly insignificant cost. For a small player, it's the number of users they would have would be their cost. But very often, some of our clients will pick up the cost for their third parties, of the smaller companies, the cogs in the wheels that have to use the system. They'll pick up the cost for them. So it can vary by customer in terms of whether, you know, they're, you know, taking on all the costs, or they're having, you know, some of the smaller players actually pay by the user for that product.
But in order to be effective, everybody has to be on it, though, right?
That's correct. Everyone does need to be on the system, and it's been that way for 20 years in the market, so that's not really much of a hurdle today. Everyone understands that it's important that you're on a system and allowing, you know, individuals to collaborate together. With Kahua, what's also a little bit different is in our model, every company on the project has their own instance or domain of Kahua. They have their own Kahua set up the way they want to work. And with their Kahua, they can exchange data, documents, and workflows with other companies that are on the Kahua platform as well. So that's another way to make it even a more efficient process that would work well for everyone, because each party can use it differently than just the one party. With the legacy systems, it's one application that works the same way for everyone on the project. And for this, we can set it up for different parties that have different needs of aggregating data and disseminating information to collect that in different types of applications, depending on the type of company that you are.
Now, is there an opportunity for Kahua to also be kind of a marketplace, so everybody that's on Kahua can, like, say, hey, I need this kind of a resource, and then let me see if Kahua has somebody on there already?
That's exactly right. There is a resources in terms of third parties that are available to help and assist with different companies, but we also have an online marketplace. We have a online store. We call it the K-Store, similar to, it's an app store for our customers to use and can purchase products that are developed by, you know, our third parties and business partners that are out in the marketplace.
So now, when you have such a robust offering, what's the vision? How does the story end?
The story ends when
it seems like it keeps evolving and you're flexing to whatever your customers need and want. And then it's giving some autonomy to every one of the players. So what's the big picture then?
Big picture is to have everyone in the industry using this throughout the real estate design and construction process, and globally for that matter. We are a global company. Our largest customer is CBRE, and they're deploying this globally in 9 different languages.
So now, why Atlanta? How come you're here?
I was raised here in Atlanta. And went to high school here for a number of years before we moved away. So I've always looked at Atlanta as being my home. But coincidentally, Atlanta is a great market to start a business. It's always been known for that to some extent. I think a lot of that is just due to all the resources that are available here. And it's a less competitive market, actually, than some other markets, say, on the West Coast for technology in particular. There's a tremendous number of universities that are around that allow us to pull tremendous talent from the local market. So then you have the Atlanta airport, which makes it very easy to get anywhere that you need to go. So it's a great place for starting a business.
So now, have you plugged into the technology community? Are you involved in some of the, you know, kind of portals of technology here, like TAG or ATDC or some of the players?
Yeah, on and off throughout my tenure, I guess I've been involved with various groups and associations over the years, and have, you know, different ways in which I do participate in the local community.
Now, how do you kind of get access to this talent? Like, you're just, hey, Kahua is doing great things, come here and join the party?
Once we can introduce them to what we're doing, we are a cutting edge technology. And so that attracts resources when they know that they're able to work on the leading edge type of technology in the marketplace. That's fantastic. I think our culture is very important in attracting individuals. It's how you treat employees is incredibly important, and we make sure that's known and something that we are very proud of, how our what our culture is within the company.
And then what do you need more of right now?
We're always looking for top level talent, and we think we have ways that we can very easily attract new talent. I think as a fast growing company and a high technology company in one of the hottest spaces of technology, it's very attractive what we can do in terms of what we can offer employees coming on, and the future opportunity it provides to them is certainly very attractive.
Are the universities doing a good job in terms of taking this? The technology side, I'm assuming they're doing a good job, but kind of understanding the construction industry and seeing where that those two worlds kind of collide?
I don't know how intentional they are necessarily about that. You have some of the universities that do offer building science programs that are certainly relevant. And then you have other universities such as Georgia Tech that certainly produces a lot of individuals with tremendous technology capabilities that are very valuable to us as well. And so it's kind of a blend. Sometimes we're looking to recruit individuals with purely a technology background and technology experience. Other times we do want individuals that are more industry specific in terms of understanding how the industry works. Some of our consultants, it's valuable that they've been in the industry itself.
Now, what is the kind of real estate building construction company? What's an opportunity for them that they're not seeing that Kahua could solve some of the problems?
Again, where I see that Kahua is very different is with technology. Historically, you would develop or deliver a product to a customer. A customer would adopt that technology, and you would try to get to that goal line, cross that finish line, and then you're there and you use that technology that way for the next 10 years. That's not the case with Kahua. It's an ongoing evolution. Businesses are rapidly changing. You need a technology that keeps up with the business and changes as the business changes over time. So we are, for a given customer, the implementation really never ends. They're constantly tweaking and improving their business processes and leveraging the technology that's at hand. So I think it's a very different business model than exists for most any type of technology in any industry.
But if I'm building a high rise, is this something like I should be switching to Kahua? Or if I'm building kind of a mixed use, is that the best fit for Kahua? Or I'm developing a neighborhood, like who are the people that should be using this right now?
Kahua customers today are virtually all customers entered real estate and construction except for residential. We do not target single family residential. The multifamily residential we have to absolutely go after. We're also in the highway heavy market. Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission is a large customer of ours. We're also in the industrial market. We're in the commercial market. We target healthcare heavily for specifically their design and construction process.
So they're building a hospital.
They're building a hospital. We have one of the most renowned healthcare organizations in the United States as our customer. Mm-hmm.
And then where's the first place they're going to say, hey, this is different? Like what's going to be something noticeable that to them that says, hey, this is making my life easier?
So for example, when we originally won one of these deals with a large healthcare entity here in the U.S., what we're able to show them is that they had an existing system in place that pretty much met their needs for just basic project management. But what we're able to show them is what other components is this system not able to meet? And they were able to show us a project closeout process that they needed to have that wasn't supported by the technology. And within just a couple of days, we built that application running in Kahua and then showed it to them. And then they said, we get it. We understand. And since then, they have built other applications, a utility shutdown application and a healthcare organization. That's very important. If you're going to have to shut down the utilities, the details are extremely important in terms of process. They also have a firearm hot permit process that they were able to develop on Kahua. These are things that they couldn't get out of the legacy type of technology that's out there today.
Now, is that one of the challenges when you have something that flexible? They don't know what they could have. And then so a lot of times it takes them like giving you kind of a dream list of, hey, can you do this? And then you're able to do this. And then that opens the floodgates, right?
Correct. What we'll typically do is if we'll take one process that they're not able to leverage technology
that they wish they had.
That they wish they had, or wish they could do something other than a spreadsheet with. Right. When you have 30 different people working on the same spreadsheet, that's not an ideal mechanism to deal with information. And so we can very quickly model up that application. We've had instances where we've been on site and doing a couple day demo to a customer. And one day they say, we'd like to do this. And the next day we actually can show that running and working in Kahoot in a working application.
And then once that happens, that's where the light bulb probably really goes off and goes, okay, this can do lots of things that we wish we could always have done, but now there's a way to get it done.
That's right. They see that this is really the future. That's what we've heard several times is they would look at the existing technology and say, this is the past. And they look at Kahoot, this is the future. This is the way right. things are going. It's the next generation of technology with the Kahoot's platform as a service technology.
Good stuff. Well, congratulations on all the success.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure being here today.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the coordinates for Kahoot website? Well,
I would go to kahoot.com. That's KAHUA.com, kahoot.com.
And then if you're a recent tech grad or somebody who wants to join the team, go there. There's a way to connect with you there.
Yes, there's a resource page there. Please do come to our website. Please come out and visit Kahoot. I think you would be absolutely amazed at the company of what Kahoot is today.
All right. Hey, stay with us, man. We're going to visit with a couple more guests.
I'd love to, if that's all right.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us the president with McKibben Places, Mr. Eric Rowan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well, man. What'd you learn in that last segment?
Actually, we talked a little bit before we came in, and we had a lot in common as far as what our needs are with project management software. So we'll probably talk some more.
You are welcome.
See that? We're your wingman.
You.
Where are those commission forms, Lee? I'll go
That's
get
right.
one.
That's great.
Well, Eric, tell us about McKibben Places.
Yeah, so McKibben Places is a 70-year-old hotel development company. We started building our own hotels in the late 40s, early 1950s.
You don't look that old.
I age well. and then over the years, our company started franchising with Marriott and Hilton, and eventually started taking on third-party hotel management contracts
right.
while still developing hotels for ourselves. And then more recently, we've started taking on third-party development opportunities where we might be managing the property afterwards, but we're not the owner of the hotel.
So now how'd you get into this business?
Well, my background's in architecture, and I got into the hotel development side of the business about 20 years ago, and just really stuck with me and came to McKibben about 17 years ago.
So there's a lot of creativity in the hotel world, right? That from an architect standpoint?
That's right. That's right. It's nice because I'm still designing every day. I'm not, on the computer doing drafting or anything, but I still get an opportunity to share my vision as it relates to our projects.
So now tell us about McKibben Places. Is that going to be like a place? That's the company, right?
Yeah. So McKibben Places is the development arm of the McKibben organization.
So is there going to be a McKibben Places place, like
yes.
a hotel and mixed use or something?
Well, McKibben Places, we have a corporate mm-hmm. office in Alpharetta.
Right.
And we're just still going on and continuing to develop hotels throughout the Southeast.
And that's all over the place. So not at your headquarters
no.
in Alpharetta, but there's not going to
be. No, we've got projects now in Florida, in Georgia, and North Carolina.
And
they're ongoing.
So now who do you look to partner? Like people come to you and say, hey, help us.
Yeah. So our target client, besides the hotels we develop for ourselves, are other developers that either don't have experience in developing hotel projects, or they just don't have the internal resources to facilitate the process from due diligence all the way through opening of the property.
Now, do you have a specialty that we got to call Eric and his team?
Just across the board, we pretty much do everything.
Do you have a favorite?
I guess we spend most of our time during the construction process. I'm more heavily involved on the design side because of my mm-hmm. background, but our staff, we've got a pretty diverse staff. We have project managers that have backgrounds in interior design, construction, hotel operations, and procurement.
So you have your teams here and then you deploy them out, or do you work with kind of the boots on the ground and wherever?
Yeah. So it depends on the project. Sometimes on projects that are, a lot more, the projects that are a lot more complicated and the bigger projects typically will actually deploy a project manager to actually stay locally on site full time. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, we still stay out of our Alpharetta headquarters and then go visit the job site as frequently as needed.
Now, how'd you land in Alpharetta?
Well, I,
you went to high school here?
No, I didn't. Actually, I went to high school up in New York. I went to Syracuse University and I had a bunch of friends that moved down this way. So that brought me to Atlanta, and I worked for an architecture firm up in Alpharetta during the mid 90s. And that's kind of what drew me up there.
Now, how, like, you could have put your headquarters anywhere though.
Yeah. So, so we'd been in Gainesville, Georgia since the 1940s and 50s. And, we started seeing a need, to be able to kind of recruit talent out of Atlanta. It's kind of a long commute. So, we found Alpharetta is kind of good middle ground because we still have staff that are from, North Georgia area and also from the West side. So, we wanted to find a good community with great culture. We're downtown Alpharetta, and it just seemed to be a good place in the middle.
So now, what's your kind of take on the trends? How are things going? Are you bullish about how things are going nowadays?
Still bullish. Construction costs are getting really, really high. So some deals are not penciling like they would have 3 or 4 years ago. So it's a little bit more tricky to get the deals done. But I think we still got some runway left.
And then what about regions of the country? Are you seeing certain regions are better than others right now?
We pretty much stick in the south, southeast, but, you know, from my colleagues that are doing work around the country, they're seeing the same kind of trends.
So now what about in within the south? Are there some cities that are hotter than others?
Yeah, we've been focusing for our own developments a lot on more urban projects in areas with higher barriers to entry. We've done a lot of work in Asheville, North Carolina, and Charlotte. We're doing some projects in Atlanta right now.
And then that's in, are these kind of opportunity zones, or are they?
We have some opportunity zone projects as well, that we're working on. You know, a lot of it has to do with, you know, not just the activity in that certain market for travel and, hospitality, but also the available brands in those markets and, and how much there is in that market.
So what's the most rewarding part of the job for you?
I would say opening day is probably the best, you know, when everything is polished and when the first guests check in.
And then what has been your biggest success story?
We've got two really, exciting projects that, we've finished up recently. One is a dual brand project in Charlotte, North Carolina at the Epicenter, which is a 22 story tower that we built over a multi-story mixed use development.
So that was already there?
That was already there. So we had lots of challenges we had to overcome. We had businesses operating below us.
A historic building?
No. It had been built in the early 2000s. And there was a condo project, that started and stopped when they were just getting above the center. And we came in and, purchased the air rights and built the tower over it.
Wow. So that must have been a challenge, a puzzle to figure out.
There was a lot of logistical challenges, a lot of design challenges that we overcame and construction challenges. But the property's doing great. It's been open for about a year now. And then the other project is, in downtown Asheville. There was a 50-year-old, high rise called the BB&T building, that had, kind of outlived its useful life. And, we redeveloped it as a hotel and condo project, pulled all the skin off the entire building, extended the slabs out, and that was a 20-story project. And that one is the hotel opened in October.
So now you've seen firsthand how the difference kind of a new look and feel can be in revitalizing.
Oh, yeah.
Not just the building, but it could be the whole community around it, right?
Absolutely.
And isn't that a missed opportunity for some cities to not really invest in the bones of their kind of what they have and just try to kind of maximize that?
That's an interesting question, because sometimes cities grasp on to some of the older buildings in town, even if they don't look great, but they're just tied to them because they've always been there.
Right.
And we had to kind of navigate that when we got this project approved. We had a lot of public meetings just voluntarily with the neighborhood and the community to try to get their input on what they thought this building should be. And we took all that input when we designed it.
And that's always a balance, I guess.
It is, because as you can imagine, you can't make everybody happy ever.
Right.
But you try to hear the most voices, and I think we did a pretty good job there.
And then I think in some cities, the challenge is that if you tear everything down and start from scratch, you kind of lose the character and kind of the heart of the city. But you need to have some things torn down.
Asheville's a great example of that, and we were really sensitive to that aspect. We went around, we did a lot of studies on a lot of the architecture, because this is a 20-story high rise that was very modern, and we kind of dialed it back to more of a transitional Art Nouveau type high rise, which was kind of a different take on it.
So now when you're doing something that creative, how do you kind of land on that?
A lot of research. And like I said, a lot of meeting with people. We met with all the members of the design review board, which was made up of local architects and business leaders, and got their take on it. And it was interesting, because a lot of the people on these boards, they weren't just business leaders in Asheville, but they grew up there too. So they remember coming to downtown.
Right, so they have an visceral kind of feeling about this. It's absolutely not just like a, you know, looking
that's
at
right.
this.
That's right. We had one architect, and she said, you know, that building, I know that it seems dated, but when I was a little girl and my mom took me downtown to go shopping, that was the most amazing building in all of downtown. So we were sensitive to that when we went through the process.
So now, as a leader of your company and coming from this architect background, does that give you kind of a unique empathy to when you're doing a project and a lens that you're looking at it maybe through that way, from this design and it has to fit and things like that, those qualities?
I think so. I think that one thing that makes our company unique is that lens or that perspective. We have a lot of different perspectives, from being hotel owners, being in the hotel management business, having contractors and architects. So that empathy comes out in all aspects of the design and construction process, because we've been on the other side, you know, many times.
Right. And then right now, you're still in growth mode. Do you need more talent? Like, what do you need more of right now?
Yeah, we're still in growth mode. I think that at this point right now, we have a great team of project managers. And I think this year we're going to be looking to bring in some younger folks that have design or construction backgrounds or education, and try to grow internally some project management staff.
And then what's, like, if they're coming out of school, what's the background that they have?
Architecture, construction sciences, those are the two big ones.
Good stuff. Now, if somebody wanted to learn more about you and your firm?
They'd go to mckibbonplaces.com. That's mckibbonplaces.com.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for sharing
your story. Thanks for having me.
Hey, hang with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with this morning, okay? All right.
You could tell he's a bad influence.
He's already handed out.
I think Steve and Eric deserve
that's their reward.
If you want to open that up and take a sip, feel free. I don't want to be.
All right. This is a judgment free zone here.
For our listeners, we're going to switch gears a little bit and go from construction to consumption. We have with us founder and principal with Victory Spirits Development, Mr. Michael Shore. How are you, man?
I am great. And I think these gentlemen next to me are going to even be better
in a few seconds.
They're having a little 4-year bourbon.
They're celebrating. Yeah. They're surviving the interview. Well, Michael, tell us about what you got going on. You've been on, I think, the show before, and you're an entrepreneur that has a career that I don't think
he
we
can't
cover.
Hold a job.
I don't think he can
hold a
job.
Trying to find a nice
right.
way to say
no. It's a short attention span. That's what it is. By the way, thank you guys for having me here today. You know, this is something totally new. I'm here to talk about the Bourbon Bond Fund. And what a lot of people don't know is that in this country, we know that spirits are highly regulated, but an individual can't just decide that they want to invest in bourbon, a wholesale bourbon, own it. They can't buy it. They can't sell it. You have to be a licensed producer. At the same time, I think you're all aware that we're in a boom of interest in American whiskeys and aged whiskeys in particular, and bourbon is at the head of that pack. The growth, year over year growth, is significant, and there's no sign of it slowing down. And as a result of that, you've got a lot of these smaller producers, craft, right? That boom really started in maybe 2014. And in 2014, there were about 500 local producers. Now, remember, the industry is dominated by five big players that control 85%. And that's a lot of the brands that you know and love are produced by these big corporate entities, Brown-Forman, Diageo, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's really a growing segment that today's consumer. They want local. They want authentic. They want all the handcrafted. They don't want, you know, mass produced. But the reality is in 2014, there were 500 local craft distillers in the United States.
And then those are people that said, hey, you know what? I like this. I'm going to do this. Maybe they're in a second career and they were doing it. Not, I don't want to say they're hobbyists, but maybe they started out as something that they were doing, maybe craft beer, and they were doing that. And it evolved into, hey, I think I can pull the, I got some money. Why don't I?
There's the key, right? I think they saw, and rightfully so, the market opportunity. But the high cost of entry, the millions of dollars.
Right.
It costs,
different than making beer in your kitchen. This is $1 million can be right to build.
Probably. I wouldn't think you could open a distillery for less than $2 million.
Right. So millions of dollars. So now they're investing their nest egg. This is their 401k. Mm-hmm. They're putting all their chips on the table to see if this is going to work.
Right. And we're talking about a product when we're talking about whiskeys that need to age. Bourbon by law. In order to be called bourbon, first of all, and it's the only regulated spirit by Congress, because it is the true American spirit. So bourbon, the recipe has to be at least 51% corn. It has to be aged in a new American charred oak barrel, which not a used one, right? You can finish things, or you can make scotch in port wine barrels, you have to make bourbon, and it has to be in contact with new American charred oak. To be considered a straight bourbon whiskey, it has to be aged at least 2 years. A lot of bourbons on the market are 2 years, and they're good quality bourbons. But where you start getting the true value and appreciation is when you get to a 4 year, right? So a good example of that, Old Forth Distillery here in Atlanta. They opened in 2014, and people mostly know them for gin and vodka because they could distill that and sell it the next week.
Right. That's something that they can produce and they can and sell it fairly quickly. They don't have to wait 4 years. There's no time.
Correct. And if you think about that, not only do they have to buy the ingredients to distill it and have to have stills, then they have to buy barrels. Every barrel costs real money.
Right.
I mean, they're several hundred dollars for a barrel. And so a distillery, they could have another $1 million in change, at least $2 million in just aging inventory that they can't sell
and do anything with for 4 years.
4 years.
It's just tied up immediately.
Right. And so the idea for Bourbon Bond Fund really came out of the experience that I saw in working with Old Forth Distillery in this 4 year lag time. And there aren't a lot of businesses that can invest that kind of capital in addition to the infrastructure, but kind of to tie up their money. There is a growing reliance on sourced whiskeys. And typically there have been
What is sourced whiskey?
In other words, they're buying already distilled liquid juice, as it's called. And they might do something to it. They might finish it. They might add an ingredient. But it's been really hard to get a consistent source of a high quality aged whiskey, right? It's available, but it's not, you can't count on it. So you can't build a brand on something that you don't even know 2 years from now or a year from now, you're going to have enough of. So they didn't, they did it the old fashioned way and a great way, but it also showed me the drain on their resources. So I went out in search of a high quality source of distilled whiskeys and a producer who had the resources and the capacity to build out to fulfill demand. And we created a program called Black Dog, White Dog, which was a fixed price program where a distiller could buy a barrel of whiskey unaged. They don't take possession of it yet. And it would be aged for 2, 3, 4 years, whatever they want, at a fixed price. So they'd have no hidden costs. They would still have costs. They'd have to do that, but they wouldn't have to buy stills. They don't have to buy the barrels, right? And we did the numbers, the calculation on it. And if they were to buy sourced whiskey from one of the conventional big producers at a certain amount of money, but then they would be charged, you know, monthly handling fees and insurance and all this. And by the time that barrel of whiskey got to be 4 years old or 3 years old, even, it could be $2,500 in hard cash tied up in that barrel. And so with this model, the original model was you'll pay less than that and the pricing will be included. You know, you'll pay about $1,000 less than
that. So now I get the barrel done. Now I can do things.
You can put it in a bottle, right?
So, and I can finish it and put add different things to it, or it's just
everything has to be approved by the TTB, the federal government. So the recipe. So there's definitely things you can do. I mean, you could take that bourbon and you could, you know, put it in a that way. You could put it and finish it in a sherry cask,
right? And then I can have my own brand,
yeah.
And so use that as my base,
yeah. And here's actually an example right here. This is a brand, by the way. This is the first people. Well, the second, actually, because we brought a bottle to Oysterfest. Joe Louis Bourbon is coming back. Mm-hmm. And this is an iconic brand. A lot of people don't remember Joe Louis, but they're going to know it now. Joe Louis, you know, first African-American national hero, boxing great, really at a time in America when we needed.
And it's Black History Month.
Yeah.
That was good.
So what a lot of people don't know, in 1952, after he retired the first time from boxing, as the 12-year reigning world champion, he went into business. You know, he was leveraging his brand. And one of the products was Joe Louis Bourbon that got released in 1952. And it lasted for a couple of years. You can go to eBay now and find a bottle for $1,500, a collector's edition, but it hasn't been produced. But our client is, a Joe Louis Distilling, and they are working with the family. They have the licensing. Wow. And anyway, the point I'm making is that this is a very high quality product. And it is being sourced, right, from the same source that we're using. Now, let me take you full circle to what the Bourbon Bond Fund is. So we discovered that a lot of these small producers, they had a desire, there was demand for this bulk whiskey.
Right, the product.
But now, even at a cheaper price, they're saying, I don't have the cash for that. So because it's the way the industry is regulated, you can't just say, I'm somebody else. I'll pay for it for you. You know, you can't do that. So what we did is we put together an investment fund, and as long as you're an accredited investor, you can buy units of ownership in an entity. And there are multiple funds, but every fund is its own entity, and you're buying units of interest. And what we are doing is we then invest. We finance the distillation and the aging of a product at the wholesale cost. And when that product is sold to the brand or to any, you know, licensed buyer in 2 or 4 years, and we have different funds. The ones we have right now are just 4, but we're about to launch a 2-year, and I'm going to explain why that I brought Joe Louis for that reason. And then when that bourbon is sold, the investors share in the upside. So the potential is a 50% overall return in a 4-year investment, and probably in a 2-year, it's more like a 25 to 28% return. A barrel of 4-year wholesale bourbon today costs between $3,000 and $3,600. I mean, maybe you can find it somewhere for $29, but it's not all consistently the same quality. One of the things that was important to me in finding a source was not just anybody who can do it. This is a distillery that's in the Blue Hill Mountains of Virginia, southwestern Virginia, which is right over the Kentucky border. It is handcrafted. It is in pot stills, which if anyone knows what that means, it's a smaller, rounded still so that there's separation. There's what's called heads and tails, and then there's the heart. The middle of it is the best, right? There's higher levels of ethanol and, you know, in the top and bottom. And in this case, and a lot of producers don't do this, our distilling partner only uses the heads. So he discards the heads and tails. So this is really, and it starts with incredible ingredients, non-GMO corn, locally sourced in Virginia, grown right around the corner. Same thing, locally sourced rye and imported barley. So a high-end product. And that's what we're allowing investors to participate in. And so when we sell those barrels at $3,000 or $3,200 a year, when the investor cost might have been on average about $1,600 a barrel, well, that's a pretty good return on investment. So we're really excited about it. And the key to this is, number one, great source. We have a partner in Davis Valley Distillery, and these guys have sampled it so they can tell you if it's any good. What do you think?
Very good. I mean, it's phenomenal. Very surprising. I mean, right? Yes.
And I mean, this is as good. I mean, Did
you? Yeah, I thought it was great.
See, you guys can't drink because you're still working.
I know.
Well, I'll leave you some. So, it's really cool and it's exciting. And
so now, but walk me through if I'm thinking of investing in this rather than investing in something else,
like the stock market that's crashing today.
Is it?
Right, I don't say sure. It's expected to be open down like 300 points or something.
So now this is something, and as part of a portfolio, this investment. Mm-hmm. And, so now tell me about kind of the math of this. Mm-hmm. How many, like what's going to be produced? What am I investing in?
Yeah. So we're currently open with the Bourbon Bond Fund 2. One closed in January. And fund two is we're raising a maximum of $2 million, which would be that we would lay down 1,250 barrels for 4 years. And then right behind this, we're launching the Bourbon Bond Fund 3, which is a 2-year. Now it's a lower return, but it's a shorter term. And the reason we're doing that is that 2-year, this Joe Lewis champion of them all, bourbon, it's a beautiful.
You guys the bottle's beautiful.
It's the whole thing is incredible.
Very nice.
But they're using the straight bourbon whiskey, as I said, 2 years. And most whiskeys you see, straight bourbon whiskey. And so this is what I would call an emerging. It's a startup, but it's an emerging brand because it's already.
And it has a history.
It has a history. Right. There's going to be 20,000 cases sold.
Value. Yeah. Right.
Another brand would take them 3 years to get this. We already have major markets. When are we getting it? Right. Mm-hmm. So their needs are significant. And what our investors are investing in is bourbon that brands like Joe Lewis, not just Joe Lewis, will use. And I don't want to get into calling out anybody, but there's a lot of brands that we know that are sourced, Templeton, even Dickel is sourced, so it's not like a new thing, even some of the larger things. So it's really kind of an exciting moment here and I should also say that what surprised me is that the very first person that agreed to invest in the first fund, which no one had done this before. So that's was a vice president of sales of a major producer because he doesn't own the company.
Right.
But he's on the front lines of knowing, oh, wow, this is valuable. And, and this is a good thing. Demand. And I can't say who it is and what the brand is, but they have a brand of bourbon, but it's, he was like, no. So he invested. There's a whole nother category of investors, which we discovered were, people that were later in their mature life and looking at the gyrations in the market. And, if there's something that they can look at, 4 years is about as far out as they want to look at. And to know that they're going to get something that over indexes the market and that there's no real gyrations in this. And I take that, at least for the foreseeable future. There have been gyrations in history. But that's also why we're very bullish about this. Remember the days when everyone was having Cosmos and vodka was a thing that nobody knew about, right? So in 1970, this is a fact that I love. In 1970, American whiskey, of which bourbon is part of the category, but that also includes blended and whatever. American whiskey sales were 37 million cases in 1970. The market for bourbon crashed after that because all of a sudden, this thing called vodka and Stolichnaya and Russian vodka, came into the market, and then the disco craze, everybody was drinking vodka, right? So brown whiskeys, you know, not, didn't go away, but a lot of, if anyone has gone to the Bourbon Trail, you know, a lot of the distilleries that are, where some of these big brands are made, you know, were bought up by these big players because they were going out of business, right? You know, they couldn't do it. Why is Pappy Van Winkle so treasured now? It's because it's aged 23 years. And in 1981, you know, when they were pulling back on production because they weren't sure that this was going to come back, right? Well, not only is it come back, we all, would you agree that the consensus is that people talk about bourbon and whiskeys now and it's more popular, right? I mean, I'm not, I
and
have
that's
the facts,
not just
but I'm asking
in the United States, right?
No, no, it's Japan, you know, yeah. But in millennials are driving the sales of these more, they're spending more money on the $35 plus, not the $12 to $15, $18 bottom shelf stuff. So there's a whole demand for that. But I think that, you know, what's cool, what's exciting to me is that last year, despite we're seeing this 10% annual growth, it's actually 2018 numbers I have, not 2019, but 24 million cases of American whiskeys were sold with an increasing share of bourbon. So we are, even if we continue at the pace we're at, right, which without anything really pushing it even higher, and I can't imagine it's going to get any lower, it's going to be 8 years till we are even at the levels we were in 1970. So there's a demand, supply and demand issue here, which is why right now the idea of, you know, investing in something that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. And look, there's a whole growth in no alcohol, but that's not going to replace this. It's a new category. But, you know, maybe 20 years from now, it'll be a different story. But for the next decade, this isn't going to be worth any less. And to me, you know, that's pretty exciting. If you can also be helping brands like a Joe Louis brand return to market, knowing that their reputation is staked on a high quality bourbon whiskey. So it's cool.
Now, the Bourbon Bond Investment Fund, mm-hmm. is there a lot of investment funds and
no, there are none.
So this is the, if you want to participate in this kind of craft,
I'm assuming there'll be some because I have a lot of people have been kicking the tires who are in the space. How did you do that? How does that structure?
Right, but you had to thread a needle in order to pull this off, right?
Because
it difficult for other funds to?
Well, I mean, I don't think everyone can say that they have a producer who is very.
So that's the key in order to make it work.
Well, you have to have a good quality product, and you have to have a producing partner who's committed and who's expanding. He's already added one 50,000 square foot warehouse, and he called me the other day and told me he's got his eye on another building. And I'm like, well, okay, well, that's, you know, that's your call. But so he's, you know, that's a unique situation, and it's also because of the fact that it's being done in a truly handcrafted. Model. So that's part of it. That's very significant. The second piece of it is, you know, I don't think that anyone, if they look at our documents, they can figure out that they can go get lawyers and go get SEC in, but no one had done it before. So, you know, I'm not suggesting we're ever going to be the only one, but right now there isn't anything that I know of. I've had a number of people, you know, who are fund planners ask for the, prospectus and sign their agreements and, you know, they're not going to invest, but they're like trying to recommend it to somebody else. But
so now, is this going to help that small person that just said, hey, I should do this?
And yeah. Maybe
this will give them an opportunity to stay involved and stay able to
think about it this
demand?
Way. Think about it this way. If I am a small producer and okay, I don't have the capital to buy the unaged, even at that lower price that we created, right? I don't want to tie up my capital for 2 or 4 years. But if I'm willing to pay more, I'm willing to pay $3,000 a barrel because it's at the time that I can turn it around and put it into a bottle. So you take those bottles, you know, and that may be...
How many bottles are in a barrel?
Well, it depends on a 750 milliliter bottle. You're really looking at about 50 cases. So, you know, you got, it's 150 to 200 bottles, mm-hmm. right? And so that can be $8,000 to $10,000 in revenue, or even if on the low end, if it's six, right? Still doubled your money. So all of a sudden the idea of paying more for a barrel isn't as painful as paying less for a barrel and still sitting on the money. So this is what we think is really the game changer. Literally it's like you could get in the bottle of this Joe Louis, by the way, this was from the first run that were bottled on Thursday last week, and the CEO, who was on his way to Florida, stopped on Saturday to hand deliver me samples of the bourbon. But literally, you know, that shows you how fast. So they could, they literally, it would have been the equivalent of them, you know, receiving, you know, the barreled on Wednesday,
right,
having it bottled on Thursday and have it in the market on Monday. Right.
So is there an opportunity for maybe the person that has this distillery that is doing, gin and these other brands that you can turn around faster and say, hey, I want to, I'll take this brand I've already established in my local market and say, I can throw a bourbon in there.
Absolutely.
Using this and I can get to market much faster.
Absolutely.
And I can leverage the brand I already have a following with locally.
And that's where, how it should be. Right. And they can still do something to it if they want.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of decisions to be made. How, what's the proof? You know, do you want to proof it? I mean, when it comes out of the barrel, it's 120 proof. So, you know, when you see cask strength, and that's typically what bourbon is, 120, 121, 123. And most bourbons are, you know, this one is 90 proof, the Joe Louis. Most are, you know, 85 to 90. Some are 100. The Old Fourth is 100, and that's a whole specific reason, which I'm not going to get into, about bottled in bond, which is a cool thing. But, yeah, so, you know, you can make different choices. You could then go and there's a lot of, what they call oak adjuncts. So if you know that, like, Maker's, 46 is, after, it's the Maker's same recipe, but afterwards they put it in barrels for 8 weeks that have extra staves in it. So there's more liquid to wood contact. And what happens, the most important part, I mean, it, really everything's important, but the most important part of aging is the contact of the whiskey to the oak. And right, that's what provides the color. That's what provides the most contribution to the flavor, but it also has to do with mouthfeel, right? And that changes when there's extra oaking. So like Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, which is my personal favorite, best of the main produced, you know, is basically because it went in and it got another whole double oaking. And have you guys had that? Anybody? No. No. But there's a whole new, but so there's, you know, there's a whole movement now to do things where you can just add more oak. So you could buy this and you could put it in a tank, you know, for 6 weeks and add more oak, you know, pieces of oak or staves or chips or whatever. It's done in winery business all the time. It's a new, relatively newer thing in the spirits business. And you could then create something else, right? Create another version of this and a limited edition or whatever. So there's a lot of options, but it can go right into the bottle because it's great stuff.
And then you said that there's still an opportunity to get into the next fund.
Yeah, the next fund is open now and it closes at the end of March. And it's unclear because the demand is really growing for the 2 year. We were going to wait till after this one closes to the two, but it might end up opening sooner. So we're working on that.
Right. And then if somebody wanted to learn more about the fund, what, whether they want to invest or maybe they have a brand that they want, correct, to see if they can get access to the,
so product. there's everything is available on victoryspirits.com. But there's also a specific, the Bourbon Bond, which takes you to the same page, but to the exact page of the latest offering. Mm-hmm. And everything's online. Anyone who is interested, there's a form to fill out to validate their status and agree to a non-confidentiality. Then they get an email with access, secure access to all the documents to review. You know, we make it, it's pretty straightforward. Everything is there.
Is there a minimum investment?
$25,000 is the minimum. So per unit. And the maximum, you know, again, is if someone wanted to buy out the whole fund, they could. I'm not expecting anyone will do that, but most of, in the first fund, we did have, about 50% of the investors, maybe more. 60% of the investors were buying multiple units. You know, they weren't just buying one. So, yeah, I mean, it's exciting. And as I was driving over here, you know, I was listening to, you know, Marketplace and talking about, because of all the China, things and how much the global markets are dropping and that the anticipation today that the opening bell was going to be 30% drop. And you know what? If I were 70 years old, I wouldn't want to have to wake up every day looking at the market to figure out what's my nest egg doing today.
Yeah. Well, best of luck. It sounds like you're doing some interesting things, and it must be so exciting for you being a serial entrepreneur in so many different industries to see another disruption in the marketplace.
I always say I love creating something out of nothing, and seeing it through to being something real. And, mm-hmm. but this is exciting in another, on so many levels, because it's not just the making of a buck for selling a product. It's really creating something that I think will enable more high quality brands to, you know, to compete in a marketplace against some major
these
players.
Giant, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the part that it's really exciting for me, is to see these smaller brands that have something in their market now mm-hmm. have an offering that can really mm-hmm. change the game.
Mm-hmm.
So one more time, the website?
VictorySpirits.com is our primary website, and there's an area called Spirits Marketplace, or go to TheBourbonBond.com, and that's where all of the investor information and the forms are.
Now, in the Victory one, can they find out some of the brands that if they can go to their liquor store to get, or
we don't really know. Not at this point. We're not. Yeah, we don't really do that. The only one. I mean, I'm sharing the story of the mm-hmm. Joe Louis because it's very relevant mm-hmm. to the Bourbon Bond Fund, and this is a new brand that is just it's launching in Michigan, which is Joe Louis's
hometown.
That next by beginning of April, and then in theory, it's going. The next plan is it's going to Caesar's Palace, because I don't know if you know the history of Joe Louis.
Well, I know boxer back.
Yeah,
in the day,
but in the last decade of his life, he lived at Caesar's Palace, and they hired him to attract crowds.
Right.
You know, and he was a greeter. So there are a generation of people, you know, in their 50 to 60 year old, mostly guys, but who remember as you know young 20 something year old going to Caesar's Palace and meeting Joe Louis. So there's that generation. But I think with this particular brand, the other piece of it, and this is off topic from Bourbon Bond Fund, that's been really interesting is that, as you know, Lee, we talked about this. I mean, my background, I started out as a journalist, you know, so I love storytelling and digital marketer and entrepreneur along the way. And there hasn't been a brand that I've been associated with that is so rich in history that we have it's almost like a responsibility, because there's a generation of customers who don't even know who know that isn't he the boxer, or was someone the other day he said, was he a baseball player? And there's such an incredible story here. And what's really exciting, aside from it being a great quality bourbon, is the opportunity to work with the family, and to really, curate the story. And this brand, to the credit of the founders, I came along after they had this concept. They didn't have their brews yet, but they had the concept. They're partnered with USA Boxing. A dollar of the sale of every bottle goes to you support USA Boxing programs, and that's actually Team USA Boxing, the Olympic boxers. Mm-hmm. And it's being launched. The reason it's not here in Atlanta yet, because there's not really a Golden Gloves tournament here. It's being launched at Golden Gloves tournaments around the country. So the first time that people will see it will be at a boxing match, where it will be featured and it will be served and will be available. And it's really a cool thing, because we're getting athletes involved, and it's not about selling booze. It's about promoting the legacy of Joe Louis and understanding who he was and what he stood for and all the things that he endured and all the things that he meant to the American people. And so we have a secondary, I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I'm going to, can I?
Sure.
So Joe Louis Bourbon is their website. And there's also a secondary website called Be Joe Louis, and has nothing to do with selling alcohol, but it is about inspiring youth.
Right, and his story, keeping it alive.
And it's really important, because we're, you know, it's about both things. We know that the brand will be successful. I mean, there's no way it can't be. Well, I shouldn't say that. Anything could happen, but no. Peter, I didn't mean that. No, there's no way it's not going to sell, but to inspire youth and to help drive fundraising, you know, and it's not just inspire them because the check is going to be cut to the USA Boxing, or the Golden Gloves are going to get a few more sponsor dollars, really, so that they live, you know, being better community members, better citizens, role models. So I'm in all of my years of entrepreneurship, there's never been one that's all come together like that.
Right. And the impact is going to mm-hmm. be real mm-hmm. for all those people. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for sharing your story.
Do we have time to drink more?
There's always time for that. It'll be off air.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you to Michael, and thanks to all of our guests here today. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Paid, and we will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.